Okay. Just going to take a minute to set up here. So last time we talked about part number six, and part number six talked about the fact that war helped develop different countries to reach their potential and develop into what they could be. That was part number six. Not going to do it again. Crystallization of national character, and because the nation of Israel is like the looking glass, like the aspaclaria, the glass or looking glass or telescope or maybe magnifying glass of the whole world. Whenever a nation is not complete, so the land of Israel is corresponding, or the people of Israel, the nation of Israel, the people of Israel and the land of Israel are not full. And therefore, when a nation does become and reach its national destiny and its maximum potential, so Israel becomes more developed as well. Israel is, of course, very unique and special, but Israel is not a world outcast. You can't say that Israel is on its own, either Israel, the people, or the country. That would be more of a galut mentality, that we're going to close our eyes and surround ourselves and build our ghettos. And eventually, when all the countries will be completed and reach what they should be, and the land of Israel will be what it should be, that will, of course, lead to the coming of Mashiach. And then all the wars, Mashiach will lead the wars of Hashem against evil, and everybody will come and worship HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and everything will be hunky-dory. That was basically the last thing that we did in section number six. And we thought that was a very unusual kind of way of looking at things, and it is. It surely is. But this number seven really becomes somewhat of a corollary for it. Basically, what it says in number seven, in part number seven, it's not a long piece, but eight is a longer piece, so we can't really debunk into two today, that chapter seven really talks about the fact that when you look at Jewish history, when you look at history, you don't just look at history, you're looking at history through the lens of Israel, and therefore the Geula of Eretz Yisrael, the Geula of Am Yisrael, is really the purpose of the whole purpose of what history is all about. And therefore, and it's hard sometimes to see where things are going, but eventually, Israel will develop into its own country and people, well, it is a people, its own country, in a very complicated way. In other words, there's something going on here that Rav Kook feels, and it's taking place with World War I, World War II maybe, present wars, in other words, something that war is able to move and undertaking along. It's hard to really understand it fully and completely what the process is. Maybe, we know Rav Tzvi Yehuda Kook once said that it's comparable to the more complicated a piece of machinery is, the more difficult it is to understand how it works. Well, the greater that the machinery can accomplish, the more complicated that it can become. It's easier to drive a car and more complicated to fly. Because when you're driving a car, you're only driving on a road or off-road. You're driving on the ground. When you're flying, you're flying up and down as well. This altitude that you have to be concerned about and drag, and aerodynamics and so forth. So in Israel developing itself, it's a much more complicated piece than simply just following a straight line. And sometimes the lines kind of seem to go out of whack. And therefore, what's happening in war is things are taking place not only in the world, but in Israel as well, only we don't really see them running in a straight line. We see that it will lead to Gula, and we're beginning to see this now, Rav Kook is going to write, because in the beginning of the 20th century, Jews were beginning to come back to their homeland, maybe secular Jews in many cases, but there were religious Jews, plus even the secular Jews are part of that process. It will eventually lead to what Rav Kook calls here, it's going to look Gulat, I'm just going to show you one word before we read the whole thing, Gulat Olamim. Gulat Olamim, which they translate here as, I'm not sure if they translate here, Gulat Olamim, maybe the next page. The redemption of worlds, right here. The redemption of worlds is Gulat Olamim, but Gulat Olamim means everlasting and eternal redemption too. Olam means the world. It's going to come to the Gula of the world, which Israel will lead, and it will come to the Gula that will be La Olam, Olam Void, Olamim. So there's a double meaning in the word Gulat Olamim, but all of this is taking place. And one of the things that Rav Kook is going to write about, this I want to show you before you actually read it inside here, with Rav Kook, and all this is coming about because of what's going on with war, is that war itself is going to lead to certain things that will be helpful to Israel. One of which is developing its own army. In other words, we're learning how to create our own army. We've never had an army until until anything in the 1920s, it was until the 20th century, I should say, Jews did not have an army. In fact, Jews were forbidden to bear arms, and Jews were not permitted to serve as in any army in any country, really, even in the 19th century. And now, as Israel will need to build its own country, inevitably it's going to need to build its own army. So one of the things Rav Kook may be alluding to a little bit indirectly is he talks about the fact, here you can see it in the English maybe, that that she has an army that she began to learn in this world war. So you read in footnote 77, what Rav Kook is really talking about is the Zion Mule Corps. And I wanted to share with you what the Zion Mule Corps actually was, because it played a very important role. Rav Kook is writing these pieces here, these parts here, during World War I, where he's outside of Israel. He's in either Switzerland or later in England. And we know how important this was. Let me just kind of share with you this piece from the Zion Mule Corps. Let me see where I put the piece up from Wikipedia here. Why don't you see where I put it? Here it is. There. Okay, this is it. Okay, so... Uh-oh, sorry, take it back, there we go. Okay, so in 1917, after World War I, there was something called the Jewish Legion, which was an official, unofficial name used to refer to battalions of Jewish volunteers, the 38th to 42nd Battalions of the Royal Fusiliers of the British Army, which were raised to fight against the Ottoman Empire during the First World War. This was formalized in the Jewish Legion, which ran from 1917 to 1921. It evolved from the Zion Mule Corps. It was raised in 1915 and fought in Gallipoli, and the Jewish Legion was formed in 1917 with the formation of one Jewish battalion, and eventually became a number of different battalions as well. The challenge was, and this goes back to when you have pictures here from Trumpeldor and Jabotinsky. There we are, Zev Jabotinsky and Yosef Trumpeldor on the right here. This is Jabotinsky on the left. So they had this idea about trying to, you know, Jews should fight. Jews should be actually productive, and Jews should be able to build their own army eventually for Israel. But how do you do that? They didn't own Israel. They were fighting for Israel, fighting the Mideast. So they came up with a plan. This was instead of Jabotinsky's and Joseph Trumbull's plan. They passed it by the British to try to form a military unit from Russian Jewish emigres from Palestine. Whoops. That it would participate in the British effort to seize Palestine from the Ottoman Empire. The problem was, the British general Maxwell met with the Jews, with Jabotinsky, and he said, "I can't have foreign nationals who are fighting troops. You can't take people who are not citizens of the British Empire. These are Jewish emigres who came from Russia, and we're going to take Russians and enlist them into the British Army." So we can't do that, but what can we do? We can come up with a volunteer transport group called the Mule Corps. Jabotinsky rejected the idea, but Trumbeldor accepted it and began recruiting volunteers. And this became the beginning of the Zion Mule Corps. It was a transportation type of made of volunteers. It served in World War I, and eventually it played a very important role. They provided transporting materials, transporting ammunition, transporting waters. So this is what is called the Zion Mule Corps. And it was called the Zion Mule Corps because guess what? They were still using mules in World War I. And there's some pictures of them down here. There's a picture over here. This is the Zion Mule Corps Ammunition Company. Later, this turned into, at the end of the First World War, it was actually turned into the Jewish Legion. And that's in August of 1917. The Jewish Battalion was officially announced. It was designated as the, I can't read the full words here, the 38th Battalion of the Royal Fusiliers, included the British volunteers, as well as members of the former Zion Corps. But it goes back to the Zion Mule Corps, which is formed in 1915. Chances are when Rav Kook is referring to the beginnings of a Jewish army, as he does in the piece we're about to read now, we haven't seen it yet, so I just showed you the brief reference to it, he's probably referring to the Zion Mule Corps, which was this group of volunteers, Jewish volunteers, who weren't living in then, you know, Palestine. It wasn't British mandate Palestine, it still was under the Ottoman Empire, but were serving together in a volunteer capacity. They were not officially troops. They were a provisionary. They were providing provisions. They actually played a very important role in a number of battles. And that's what Rav Kook is saying. You see that we have the beginnings of our own army. So the war itself is helping Jewish land or land of Israel in terms of developing in a way that will actually help us in the future itself. So all kinds of things are coming out. This is not only about countries of the world reaching their own understanding of who they are and reaching their self-development, self-national identity, but it's also for the land of Israel, the people of Israel, to be able to develop their own society as well and move back to Israel, and we'll be able to have a full society that has even an army that will develop from it. That's the key that Rav Kook is going to be talking about. So I want you to understand, when Rav Kook talks about this, it's not just simply pie in the sky. Rav Kook is probably referring to in the piece we're going to see today, the Zion Mule Corps. Question, was there a comment on that? Okay, good. So let's go see this piece from Rav Kook now. It's one piece we're going to do here, part number 7. Let me put it up on the screen again. Oh my goodness, here we go. Here it is. Okay, here we go. All right. So this is called, but the 7 we did, we're really doing what we're doing. We're doing 7. Yeah, we're doing 7. We did 6 last time. We're doing number 7. So this is nationalism, supranationalism. Supranationalism is yourself and godliness. Okay, supra, right. The appearance of Jewish nationalism, Israel's ability to incorporate the nobler elements of other nations, and Israel's mission as a godly people. So we have Jewish nationalism is important for us to kind of reach our apex in terms of coming with Mashiach. That's important. Supra means, I think, within, okay? And godliness, of course, this is all the role of God that we can't understand. And we have a mission to be a godly people as well. So what's going on here? Mitgaleh b'Knesset Yisrael, Tziva Hatzmi. There's being revealed among the Jews. Let's see if I make it a little bit bigger here. Okay. I don't know if I can see the end of it here. Maybe not. Okay. Mitgalek. Can everybody see what's going on? Okay. Mitgalek Knesset Yisrael. What's being revealed among Knesset Yisrael. Knesset Yisrael is a term Rav Kook used for the entire group of people. Like the Knesset, of course, the Knesset is the parliament. He used the term many times. He translates it in the article, calls it Ecclesia Israel. The group, like Beit Knesset, like we're coming together. So among the group of the Jewish people, among the people as a group, we're seeing Tzivya Hatzmi, we're seeing our very own colors. He doesn't mean the Israeli flag, he means your own who you are starting to come out. Not what we were shaped by being centuries in the diaspora, but rather who we can actually grow into, what we can become. And what do we see developing? And this is all because of the changes taking place in the 20th century, the wars that are taking place. You know, every one of these pieces is about a different outcome or a different purpose of living through these wars. War is bad, war is hell, but there's all kinds of positive things coming out. So the previous piece was about nations. This is really about Knesset Yisrael. Our true colors are coming out. Our true colors to be able to make our own country and bring the Jews back to Israel and make a society that will be all-encompassing and independent. Holchim ha-kochot u-mitpatchim. So the energies will grow and develop. Mitpatech means to develop. They'll develop slowly. Holechet v'shavallah. And slowly what's coming back, returning to us, chachma, wisdom, gvura, strength. Yosher is straightness, he calls it rectitude. Tahara pnimit, inner purity. I'm not sure what that means exactly. It means something spiritual, I think. Holecha tumav nivnate, the nation is being rebuilt. Mit tetakened, hi gulata, it is correcting itself or preparing itself, tikkun, for its future redemption. Let me just go to the next page here. Here we go, preparing itself for its redemption, which is gulat olamim, which will be, says Rav Kook, the gula of the entire world, or as I told you, the other interpretation, what it means not just the entire world, it's really referring to the eternal gula, the gula of the future, the gula that will stay forever. Porachat hi biyafai tefarta. It is flowering in the beauty of its teferis, of its beautifulness. Now, it's beginning to grow. Like springtime, the flowers begin to blossom and grow slowly. That's the period of time we're now. Hasn't come to summer. So this is the period of time. And where does this all come from? This all comes through all the difficult troubles that we're seeing from the war. Mitoch hamon galea tzarot hovrim aleha. From all the different waves that are flowing over us at this point, which is really World War I. The Yishuv in Israel suffered terribly from hunger during World War I. They suffered from the Ottoman Empire. The Ottomans, the Turks really beat down upon them. The Turks saw their empire being dissolved, coming apart. Mikol HaGoyim, all the nations that were attacking the Jewish people, Mikol HaNefutzot, from all the different parts. Hi Machnisa, Hon Rav Deah, She is absorbing a lot of knowledge. She means the Jewish people or the land of Israel as an entity is absorbing a lot of deya knowledge. Umeof habatal merchakim, and by looking far away, she sees mosifat atzadim atorim shemichutz al v'chusha hatzmi. She's adding all different sides of purity on the outside to make the which are personal assets. So she's including things. She's learning. We the Jewish people are learning from what's going on around us, which is true. We've often said that the nationalism or Zionism was influenced a lot about the nationalism that took place around it, different countries, different peoples. We learned from that. Could Zionism have taken place in an era where there wasn't a breakup of empires, where there wasn't pushes for indigenous peoples looking for their national destiny? Probably not. It would have been a lot more difficult. So we're learning from all these other people. It's not just simply that these people are learning what they are, and we can't continue until they are. We're learning ourselves. Kinat am mitgaberet. Which say kinat am. Kinat am, I think he translates here as nationalism. The kinat, the zealousy or the jealousness of the nation, mitgaberet, becomes strong. Hakarat atzmuta mitgadelet. The recognition of its independent nature is becoming greater, is growing. All these things we're learning. He odat kvar sheish laaretz. With the Israel knows, or the land of Israel knows, that it has a land. Of course it has a land. As Jews moved back in the 20th century, the late 19th century, and the beginning of the 20th century, the people are coming in different waves. They're starting to come to Eretz Yisrael. So we already know that we have a country. We're not, by 1915, nobody's going to Uganda. We're going to Eretz Yisrael. We're going to stay in Eretz Yisrael. Sheyesh la safa, we have a language. This is Ben Yehuda came up with a language. Not Ben Yehuda didn't come up with a language. Ben Yehuda took the language of Hebrew, of Lashon HaKodesh, and he made words, that he built words with an application from it. So for example... I'm sorry?
He rejuvenated it.
There's a pun in words there. He applied it to modern terms. So for example, a good example would be electricity. Is of course chashmal. Chashmal is a term that is used from the Yecheskel. When Yecheskel sees the Merkava, they translate the electrum. There was this kind of shimmering of light all around it. So that's a term where Chashmal comes from. When Ben Yehuda says, what are we going to call this brand new invention that's now being developed, that's coming to all the cities, called electricity, he took that word and he applied it to electricity. Unfortunately, what's happened today, by the way, is, of course, we don't take those words. Hebrew becomes influenced by a lot of other slang words or influences by other language, so that today, when you want to talk about electronics, we don't talk about Chashmal, we talk about elektronike. And you want to talk about the guy that's putting in your washing machine, he's called an installator. We've lost that kind of sense of purity, or at least a naivete in terms of trying to build a special language. But we do have, of course, many words in Hebrew. So at any rate, so we have
I was going to say that many languages of modern times have fallen into the same trap.
Yeah, yes. By the way, there is an Israeli Hebrew Academy of Languages that does decide what goes into Hebrew officially, in the same way that every country or every language has this. And not every word goes in there. Sometimes they put in words that maybe they shouldn't be there, but that's a different story. But yes, we're all influenced by it. And I guess the sad thing is, maybe not sad for us because we speak the language, is English has become the international language. In the same way that in the ancient world they talked about Greek, right, or it was the international language, or Latin was the international language in some cases. People spoke that, or Yiddish was the language that Jews spoke internationally. So in the modern world, English has become the national language, international language. You see it all over. I mean, you see today, Sfarim are being published. The English Sfarim are being published in different languages, not just Hebrew, being published in English, right? It's a whole big discussion. The Gemara Masechet Shabbos. Gemara Masechet Shabbos, towards the end of Masechet Shabbos, has a whole perek, a chunk of which discusses about what you shouldn't write Sfarim in English. And you know what? And you come to, of course, the Middle Ages, you find that people are not writing in English, they're writing translations into different languages. And the answer is because that's what people understand. We have to do it. Anyway, so yes, so our Hebrew has become, unfortunately, sadly, adulterated, influenced, I don't want to say corrupted, not corrupt, it's not a corrupt language, but it's included certain words that have been taken as loan words from different languages. But anyways, we do have a land, says Rav Kook. Rav Kook's writing this 1950. We have a land. We've learned how to make our own land. We see other people get their own countries. We have a language. We have a sifrut. We have our own. We have our own poets, and we have our own writers. These are basically talking about this, many of the secular writers. Some are religious, like Acharaam. Some of them were not religious. Some were traditional, Bialik, but some were very anti-religious. But we do have a Hebrew language. Rav Kook believes all of this needs to be part of what a society is. Sheishla, and we now have Sheishla Tzava. We now have an army, or the beginnings of an army. And that's what I told you. When he says army here, everybody says, what is he talking about? When did this happen? And what he's referring to is the Zion Mule Corps, which was founded in 1915, and Jabotinsky and Trumpeldor, these are the leaders of the right-wing movement of Chirut at that point. And Hitchila Lakir Mechamet Olam Zu. All these things began to be recognized in this world war. So Rav Kook is saying, you know what's coming out of this war? Well, there's something very positive that's happening for the Jewish people, for Israel, that things for the Jewish people are actually developing. Land, recognition of what land is, language, Hebrew literature, and even an army. All of this. Now, it's all happening in very difficult times. If you would ask people, did we have to have World War I? Yeah, the answer Rav Kook would write is yes, because we don't understand the ways of God. HaKadosh Baruch Hu has a complicated way to reach the redemption of the Jewish people. And once again, the greater the undertaking, the more complicated it becomes. You want to get to 30,000 feet, you need to fly, a plane that can reach 30,000 feet. You want to be able to fly a little crop duster, well, you don't need that many instrumentations. You want to drive on the ground, you need even less instrumentations. You simply need to know where there's a gas pedal and where's the brake, and watch your speedometer. That's all you need to know how to drive, basically, and stay on the road, of course. But the more complex, the more further you want to go, and the further the undertaking, farther you can go and reach, the more complicated it becomes. So consequently, we're not talking here simply about world. We're talking about a process which will eventually lead to the developing of Mashiach, B'nai Yisrael coming together, Gula, and so forth and so on. The Gulat, what he told before, Gulat, where is that term again? Gulat Olamim. Where is that term? Gulat Olamim. The Gula for the world, and the Gula forever and ever. The final Gula he's talking about, which the whole world will be redeemed to recognize Hashem and Mashiach and so forth. So all of this is happening in this First World War, says Rav Kook. That's part of the other one, the outcomes coming out of this. Yalkulam Yodati. Now, and all of this, who's she? She refers to Israel. She's referring to Knesset Yisrael, Ecclesia Israel. This is the feminine identity of the Jewish people. I'm not sure feminine versus masculine, but it's a feminine noun. It's a feminine noun, Knesset. That's not Knas, it's Knesset. Knesset Yisrael is feminine, so therefore all of the pronouns are going to be in the female. V'yakulam yodati sheyesh lo or chaim yuchadim. And she, Knesset Yisrael, knows that she has a special, unique light, much different than all the other countries. Shehei matrim ota, which give light to her, umatrim et olam kula al yada, and which enlighten the world through her, through the Jewish people, through Knesset Yisrael. So we know we're not just any old nation. We've learned from the other nations. We're learning from them. We're learning good. They can be good teachers for us to tell us about land and language and literature and armies and so forth. We can learn things how to go on. But we got to understand that something is unique about the Jewish people. We have the light that comes directly from HaKadosh Baruch Hu to give us spiritual direction. And yes, we can actually also as well enlighten the other people, their light comes through us. Shematrim et olam kula yadabi ayidei kach, ayidei kol zeh yachad, and together with all this, we also know, yodad hi et hasneh ki az, we know that, sneh ki az lo belakemet, that the, oh, I'm sorry, chasna, this is a terrible font, Yodati et chasna, she knows her protection, means look out for, take care of, that is strong, belokemes, she can look out for herself because she trusts in elokemes, the God of truth. So she understands that light that is coming from HaKadosh Baruch Hu is because we trust in HaKadosh Baruch Hu. So when we believe in HaKadosh Baruch Hu. So the country, of course, that Rav Kook is talking about is not just a secular country. Yeah, I mean, an army well, has to have certain religious values. It has to have a moral ethic. Literature also has to have a moral ethics, values, and Jewish values. Can't be schmutz that's out there. The same thing, language. Language, we're not talking about slang, bad words. We're talking about proper terms that are really found in Hebrew. Good terms, proper terms. So in other words, what Rav Kook is really saying here is that don't look so much at the secular Zionists. Don't look at maybe Herzl, and you know, don't even look at what he talked about here, the Jewish Mule Corps, the Trumpeldor and Jabotinsky, which were traditional, by the way, a little bit. But you got to look behind it. Behind Herzl, behind the Zionist movement, you have the inner soul of Knesset Yisrael is pushing through and demanding full expression. It doesn't end simply by secular Zionism. What is the actual, the real expression that's going on here? What's the real story here? The real story is not just creating a country. The real story is the Geulat Olamim, the redemption of the world through Israel, the redemption of Israel, which is happening gradually over time. That's the inner motivating force of all of world history. You've got to look at world history really through the lens of how it applies to the Jewish people. That's the real story. The story is the story of Jewish history. Anything else are simply sidebars that help us get there. Sometimes those sidebars become very important. Now, aspects of war, of aspects of the nation that were dormant while we were in the Galut all these years, like nationalism, like strength, because we didn't speak about strength. We didn't have a reason to have an army. Valor, idealism, even literature. We had the literature of, you know, the traditional literature of Tanakh and Torah Shebaal Peh. But literature that goes together with a country, we did not have such a literature. Even Machshava, we didn't have as much. Language, we didn't have a language that we could communicate really in a Hebrew language. People spoke Yiddish, which was, of course, but it was based upon a medieval type of German that they used to translate and connect together, which is fine. But it wasn't something unique to the Jewish people developing towards the end of time. We didn't have a homeland that we controlled. The Jews were living in Israel since the Korban Abayit, with very small exceptions. It was always a Jewish community. And Jews came back in numbers in the 1700s. The Talmidim of the Gra and many others moved to Tzfat and Jerusalem and built communities. But didn't really have a sovereign homeland. Didn't have a country that we were in charge of. We were responsible. These Jews who came and developed Israel in the 1700s, in the beginning of the 1800s, were dependent upon being supported by people who lived in the Golos, who send them handouts. Chalukah was called, was giving them money. But the idea of making a nation with a yearning to come back to Eretz Yisrael, that's really what's going on here. That is the outcome, one of the outcomes of this world war. Now, the fact that it's taken so much time, you're going to say, well, this is 1915. What, it took another 30 years before we had a country. And even then, we're nowhere near coming to the time of Mashiach. So Rav Kook's response is, things take time. If you want to build something strong, you want to build it to be lasting, to have longevity, you've got to build it slow and check and double check and make sure every piece goes by itself. Every step by step makes our national tshuva stronger. So the fact that it's taking a long period of time, and because you want it to penetrate everywhere, you want it to sop through, you want it to really be absorbed in the entire society, you want to build that this is going to be Geulat Olamim, and a redemption that's going to last forever. So that's why it's taking so much time. The Finalist Rav Kook would argue that the very fact that it's taking so much time is not necessarily a weakness, it's really actually seen as a strength in terms of what is going on. If we just suddenly ran into it, 1915, and suddenly in 1916 or 1918, we had a state, right? We were pushing for it. Well, maybe we wouldn't have understood how to make a country and build everything together. The fact that we had an opportunity to see other people try it, and we saw these things develop for us, beginnings of an army, the beginnings of a language, beginnings of literature, beginnings of valor and gevura, allowed us to be able to, when it came to building a country and fighting for it, of course, after World War II, and in the present, which we take for granted, it's able to really be a stronger process when we come towards the end of time. It's frustrating, I know, for us, because, you know what, we wish we were there, we wish we were at the time of Mashiach. Rav Kook says, yes, but, savlanut, plus it takes more time, plus you got to really, if you want to make it long-lasting, you got to make sure that it really was done, that it was done well. That's this piece of Rav Kook. So this is a very important piece. This is a piece basically says that you really, if I'm going to reach building on getting all Jews to come back there as well, and we're going to build the base of Mikdash, and we're going to make a religious country and everything else, well, this is, we're learning from World War I how to do that.
It turns the war on its head. Turns all the suffering that people are suffering, all the destruction that's taking place, all the horrors of the war. Somehow within this, God has a plan that we can't see. You know, and all the waves of trouble that are happening, inside of this, there's some kind of inner core that's leading us towards the Gula Atida. That's what he's trying to say there. Okay? Good morning, Jeff.
Good morning. I must say, I missed everyone, but I will tell you that those comments don't help the human, the Jew, in the moment of terror and the moment of anxiety and all that stuff. It's like anything else, right? It's like Moshe seeing Hashem at Sinai and not being able to see, and only seeing the back. Why? We can't see this. So you live a life of a challenge. And easier said than done, right?
Right. So that's correct. That's what makes challenge. That's why it makes this piece of Rav Kook's works challenging, because Rav Kook, remember all of this. We had eight subsections about the importance of Israel. 10 subsections were in subsection 7 about the importance of war. And Rav Kook is the last kind of guy you want to talk about war, but he's seeing within the war that he's living it through, and he's living. He's outside of Israel. The pathos. He's seeing there's positive things that have an impact upon the Jewish development. Now you're going to say, "Well, but where is it?" The answer is patience. You're right. You don't have the patience. I don't have the patience. We'd like to see it. We're now 100 years after this was written. Right? This is 2020. What are we? 2022? Yes? We're 23 yet? No. 2022. So it's 107 years. Yeah, what is 107 years? But the bottom line being, that's a short period of time in God's plan. But there is a plan, Rav Kook believes. You're going to say, well, how do we know there's a plan? The answer is, we trust in Hashem. We believe in Hashem. But Rav Kook is saying, don't say that the war was God, so to speak, turning off. You know, turned off the dial for 7 years and came back in 1917. No, there's a plan here. There's actually positive things the Jewish people are learning. There's a cost. Yes, there's a terrible cost. It's hard to explain the cost, hard to accept the cost. I think that's what Jeff is saying. I agree with that. But Rav Kook is saying somehow you can really see what it's all about. So that's piece notes.
I agree with Rav Kook, but unfortunately, or fortunately, we don't live 1,000 years.
Okay, and that's true.
And if you live 100 years, we don't have a lot of time to see this, do we?
No, but we have to, right. And you have to remember a person only gets to see a bit of the picture. Do you ever try to go to a museum, the old big museums, and try to see the whole museum in one day? You can't. I mean, not like museums in New York, like the American Museum of Natural History or I don't know, Museum of a Metropolitan Museum of Art. You can't see this in one day. After a few hours, if you're really running through it, you begin lagging. You say, oh man, I got to come back. You can't see the Toronto Zoo. Go out on a hot day in a Toronto Zoo, try to see the whole zoo. You can't. You get to see a walkthrough. You see bits and pieces. That's what life is all about. We're seeing parts, really, of what history is. Now, what I'd like to see the end part. I'm here. God, how come you dropped me here? Why didn't you come bring me back 100 years from now? Maybe 200 years, 300 years. I want to be there. Oh, when the saints come marching in. Oh, when the saints come march. I want to be there. I want to be in that. Everybody remember that? Right? I want to be there when Mashiach comes. When you put me here now, the answer is you can't ask that question. Now, Kadosh Baruch Hu puts all of us here in the exact correct point in time that we're supposed to be. And we have to try to just live our best in that point of time. It's a dot in history. But guess what? We're here at this point, and we got to make the best of it, even if we're not where we would like to be at the very end when Mashiach actually walked through. Maybe he will. Maybe Mashiach is coming today, tomorrow, the day after, and so forth.
Okay. Rabbi, I was going to say that we are fortunate enough today to have seen the huge changes that from 1948 to 2022. I mean, I was in Israel the first time in 1962, and when I go back now and see what goes on, I'm amazed.
Yeah,
and so on. Jeff will live another, and she'll live another 65 years when he's here at that time. He'll be amazed at what he's seen at that time from what he remembers now.
I agree. It's amazing. It's unbelievable. I remember as a kid, our rabbi Me'aliyah, who lived in the North Bronx before he moved to Pelham Parkway. A little tiny shul. And he made Aliyah, and he wrote his back. He wrote his back to sleeping on straw mattresses. Straw mattresses! Straw must have been like 1960 or something. Straw mattress. My brother went out for a date, he had to send a postcard to his wife-to-be to go out set up a date because they didn't have a phone. She didn't have a phone. They were waiting for a phone for 7 years. So if he wanted to go out with her on Thursday night, he'd send her a postcard on Monday, put it into the mailbox. They wish she would get it by Wednesday. They'd know they're going out. Come on, okay. What's going on here? It was backwards. The answer is that society has grown. It's developed. It's where we are. It's not perfect. Sure, it's not perfect. It's far from perfect. There's all kinds of squabbles and issues, and they don't have peace. We all know this. And the government is who knows where this government is going. But we've actually made milestones. The problem is, and maybe this is our challenge, we don't give hakarat hatov to HaKadosh Baruch Hu for the things that happen in a normal day. We want those miracles. We want the sea to split in half. We want to walk right through. And when God does, when God has life go along and small things happen, we say, ah, that's just nature. It's not nature. Nature is a miracle. So that's your sermon for today. There you go. Okay.
Rabbi, that's one of the. I think I might stand to be corrected, but that's one of the differences between Judaism and some of the other religions. We believe that Hashem gives us a direction, and that the world will going upwards and onwards.
Yes.
Many religions believe in just a circular path, that everything is the same from one day to the next.
Right.
And the fact that we're going forward is a huge, huge schut on our part to be able to see it happen.
Yes, and we are going forward. And it might be going for us what we call a snail space, but remember, the snail is also moving. The snail gets to where he wants to go. For the snail, that's that pace he's moving at. When you look at the snail and he's gone nowhere, he's actually moved along. Or I once talked, I think Morris gave me the book to read, and I forgot what it was, The Language of the Trees, where the trees actually speak to each other, only they send messages that move along like maybe a foot a minute or something like that. It's very slow kinds of electric signals that they send to each other. So if you don't see the trees speaking, you don't see them communicating, but they're actually underground. The roots are actually passing along certain things. One tree is attacked, the other trees put up defenses. The trees learn from each other. So,
this is just a conjecture, but I don't think the tree has the same sort of need and anxiety as the human as far as communicating. But who knows? Maybe right. It does.
And maybe we'll be happy that you came as a human and not as a tree. Maybe the last time you were a tree, next time around.
Maybe life is easier as a tree.
Maybe. Yeah. Maybe, but you know what? You can't move. You're stuck where you are. You've got to figure ways to get your babies, your children, to kind of fly away. That's even going to be frustrating for a tree. The success of a tree is when its descendants are blown away, or fruit is carried away from where the tree is. That's the success of a tree. Not to have its children next to it.
You got to grow where you're planted.
You got to grow where you're planted, and you're stuck. You can't move around. Someone puts you on the very end of a windswept plane. You're stuck. You got to make it. So I'm not sure that I want to be a tree. Actually, I want to just say, Hashem, I just want to be what I am. There you go. That's the old Zusha thing.
I tell you, back to Rav Cook, Rabbi. I do think, if I had to guess, Rav Cook would be very impressed today with all the madness going on both in Israel and here. When you look, what Ralph was saying is utterly correct. When you look at what's happened since Rav Cook's time, it's a miracle. I think about it. It's a miracle.
Right. So yes, on the one hand, I'm sure people, if the World War I, were kind of hoping that they would get a state right away. Balfour Declaration. The getting of the Balfour Declaration, which is really a corollary of World War I, which promised the Jewish people that His Majesty's government will look with favor towards the recognition of some kind of Jewish homeland, that was a tremendous step. That was revolutionary. Balfour Day used to be on the calendar. Balfour Day, well, I don't even know when it is anymore, when Balfour Day was. But if you go back to before the state was formed, the people who were strong Zionists would celebrate Balfour Day the same way that you and I would celebrate Tu B'Shvat. Now it's gone because it's been overridden by anything else. Or the day that the United Nations decided to make the partition, right? Or the day that they decided to, divide, what, I forget which one, the 25th of November. What's 25th of November? Also, all these days have fallen by the wayside because the country's just leapfrogged over itself. We only celebrate 19th, we celebrate Independence Day, of course. We celebrate Yom Yerushalayim, which is significant. But every other milestone has become forgotten because we take it for granted. Anyways, this is piece number 7 out of 10. So the piece is now, we're not going to start 8. 8, 9, and 10 are a little bit longer. You'll see, as Rav Kook, you know, Rav Kook is a very, Rav Kook's sefer, as you've learned, this sefer is not an easy sefer to go through. So if we grab too much, what ends up happening is we start going like this. So but you'll see the pieces start to get longer. And the longer they get, as you know, the more complicated it is, the more difficult it is to go through. But I'm saying, but piece by piece, we're actually making some, going through this. The piece today resonates very well with me. I'm not sure what, you know, I haven't heard any, I haven't seen the reactions that we had when we did that other piece the other day that everybody said, well, what's going on here? We can't understand what's happening. And I said, you're right, okay? This actually makes a lot of sense to say that in the midst of all this horror and terror, which we wish we didn't have to go through world wars, and world wars even worse, in the midst of all this, there's a plan. Now, what is the plan? So Rav Kook is telling you, he's not doing Monday morning quarterbacking. He's actually telling you, I'm telling you what the plan is. You know, the plan is that, you know, we're learning from what's going on around us. This is leading towards a state. Now, Rav Kook never lived to see the state. He died in 1935. He never lived the dream. He never saw it take place. But he saw close enough how we went from 1915 to 1935. He surely saw things were developing. And 1935, all that he could imagine, people just could imagine, you know, Hitler was on the horizon. We talked about that on Yom HaTzmur, Yom HaShoah. We mentioned that he mentioned Hitler as, well, you know, as a very bad incarnation, like of an Amalek or something, an evil, so to speak. But I don't think that 1935 people could even imagine what was going to take place in World War II. So what we know, I don't think you guys 3 months ago, 4 months ago, could have thought beyond COVID, could have thought of anything taking place in Ukraine, right? Or 5 months ago, maybe if you guys followed the papers 4 months ago, you would have seen some things. I don't know, but surely, you know, we couldn't imagine we're going through this nonsense, not nonsense, this horrible destruction that's taking place every day in Ukraine by the Russian army. And conversely, when it started, I don't think you could have imagined the Russian army, all the setbacks that they would have, and all the pushback that the Ukrainians would give them in terms of the defeats that actually the Russians are taking place. Okay? Comment.
Quick question for you. As far as Rav Kook and, you know, back in the day, you didn't have the same sort of Palestinian population and Palestinian problem as you do today. We learned a lot about whimsical stuff from Rav Weinberger and Rav Kook, colorful stuff. But what about us coexisting with others that we're... All right, do we get into that with Rav Kook as far as
why can't we coexist with others? Why can't we coexist with others? As long as they're going to live with us, there's nothing wrong.
It's too entangled, right. Jeff.
Now, would Rav Kook?
I agree with all you guys. I'm saying Rav Kook's answer to how we do we create something there. Well, I know that, Ralph. I agree with
you. So here's what Rav Kook tend. I'll answer this, and then we'll get to talk a little about Tzvias Omer for the last 15 minutes. What Rav Kook actually says, Rav Kook does not say, he does not really talk about, let me start the other way. What he talks about in some of the sections is about Christianity. And he saw the Christian theology as leading the Western world. He does not live in a world of Islamic fundamentalism or Islamic leadership. I don't say leadership, of Islamic power as we live today. We are probably more concerned in Israel with Arab nationalism than we are with a Christian nationalism. We're not as much concerned about the evangelists who want to come develop, you know, Israel, so eventually that, you know, Jesus will come back and lead them in their understanding of history. We're more concerned day to day about terror and some of things taking place. That does not exist in the days of Rav Kook, though clearly Jews are being killed. Jews have been killed all the time. Jews were killed. The first Jew that was killed in Eretz Yisrael, I think it was 1880. I mentioned. I forgot his name. He was killed in the Neve Shaananim. Okay, he was killed by Arabs. So Jews have lost their lives for hundreds of years and for a period of time. But and Arabs did it. That was not done by Christians. But in the theology leadership that the concerns Rav Kook is talking about, he's more concerned about Christianity. He does not really get into our thing. I haven't seen it. I haven't read anything really about Islamic theology. I don't think he really saw that. He didn't come into contact with it. They viewed Arabs pretty much as I don't want to say backwards, but they were not leaders. They were simply just, you know, people who kind of etched out a living. and were lower class people and had their own societies. But no one, and to some extent, you know, how the country was going to be divided up would also make a homeland for the Arabs. Did you want that? Would you accept it? Would you not accept it? The answer is we were willing to accept it, right? 1948, they didn't want to accept us. Okay, we're starting to ramble a bit. I'm going to pull ourselves back in and say we'll leave the Rav Kook here for the next time around. We got about 15 minutes here. Let's spend some time doing some of the laws about Sfiras HaOmer, some of the traditions of Sfiras HaOmer. And we did a little bit. We talked about a little bit from where am I here? Okay, it's my Jewish Legion. Let's do it, Jewish Legion. There we go. We did the laws of counting of the Omer. I'm trying to remember if we did actually. I know we did the first part. I'm trying to remember if we did the second part. Did we do the second part of these laws of Sfiras HaOmer? It's chapter 2 from Dinei Halacha. Did we do this? Someone tell me. I don't think so. I think I wanted to do it and I never got a chance to do it. So today I'm going to get my chance to do it. And tell me if it sounds familiar, I'll stop and we'll do it. We'll do something else. So the period of course, going from what's Sfiras HaOmer really all about. And by the way, let's not forget that we are in the count of Sfiras HaOmer. If you didn't count last night, then you should remember that today is going to be day. Today is day 30. Today is 4 weeks and 2 days of the counting in the Omer. And of course, remembering that this Thursday is going to be Lag BaOmer. Okay, that's the next holiday that's coming up. These minor holidays popping up on the calendar. So by counting the Omer, we draw a line that continuously ascends from Pesach to Shavuot. The holiday of Pesach represents Israel's national side. For the Exodus from Egypt revealed Israel's uniqueness, that Hashem chose us from all the other nations, despite the fact we were sunk in the 49th level of impurity. So physically, we're getting out of the Exodus from Egypt itself. Shavuot, on the other hand, represents Israel's spiritual side, for that's where we reached the spiritual pinnacle of receiving the Torah. Pesach, we began the liberation from the yoke of Egypt. And Shavuot, we completed our freedom from the yoke of desire and human perception. So Pesach, we physically became free. On Shavuot, we liberated ourselves spiritually. We threw off the yoke of desire, of tshuka, of cheshek, of taiva, and human perceptions. We received the heavenly Torah, which makes all those who engage in it truly free. We're really free. Pirkei Avos says this. People think that freedom is like living without Torah, just sitting on the beach. No. Free, you know, nobody is free like that. People have bills to pay. People have to do things. People are controlled by everything. We're controlled by other things. You can't sit. It's very hard for you to say, I'm going to sit on the beach and do nothing, because you know what you got to do? You got to eat. And you got to get up and you got to avoid yourself and you got to take care of your body. And if you don't look, you don't watch after, watch over yourself, you got, and don't put on sunscreen and you sit on the beach, you'll become roasted and toasted and you'll end up getting very sick with heat stroke, Khalila. So there are rules no matter where you go. The key is finding the rules that will give meaning to what we are. Sitting on the beach and just following the rules of not making sure that you get sunburned to a crisp is not so going to give you necessarily happiness. That's what he's trying to say. So getting the Torah, giving purpose to life, is the spiritual freedom. Another angle, writes Rav Malamud, on the holiday of Pesach, the simple natural faith that is hidden within the soul of every Jew and remained hidden in the Jewish people's collective soul even when they were enslaved in Egypt comes to the fore. Okay, so on Pesach, the sin soul that's hidden comes to the front. On Shavuos, we rise to a more developed faith, one that's clarified and expanded by the virtue of the Torah. So you see, he's trying to say there are two parts to faith. The first one was freedom of physical freedom versus spiritual freedom. Second angle, he's saying this is spiritual freedom in a very general term to spiritual freedom in a more specific term. Natural faith is very powerful. It's the foundation of life, but it's not capable of guiding and perfecting life. In other words, you can have a spiritual moment. There are atheists that can feel have a spiritual moment. An atheist, there are non-believers who could come to the Grand Canyon and say, wow, I'm blown away by this. Or come to a magnificent moment in nature as the sun goes down and said, what an unbelievable sunset. That's a spiritual feeling they have, but they don't believe in God. So that you can have spiritual feelings, you can have faith feelings of some sort, but you can't express them. But you come to the Torah. By the way, the Torah's commandments, we're able to link all the aspects of our lives, those relate to thought, emotions, and actions to faith. So the actions and emotions and thought all get connected together. Therefore, there are two parts to freedom of faith. One is the general term, the general approach, and the second is the more specific of Shavuos, of course, is the second one. But you need the second one. You just can't sit once again. You can't say, I'm just looking at the sunset all day because the sun goes down. You can't say, I'm going to look at the sunset because, so what? What does the sunset do for me? Okay, so I enjoyed it. It's in my memory. Eventually, my memory is going to forget things unless I have a photographic memory. By tomorrow morning, the sunset memory is not going to be as clear as it was. Okay? It comes out then that the accounting of the Omer was gradually elevated. By counting the Omer, we gradually elevate ourselves in two ways, ascending from the level of nationalism to that spirituality, from natural faith, to a sophisticated faith based on Torah and mitzvot. Now, so that's what Shavuot is all about. So why do I need Pesach? Why can't I just go to Shavuot? So Rav Malamed writes, it's impossible to reach Shavuot without Pesach. Once you recognize Israel's unique nature, our segula, we can then rise up and attain the Torah. Once we realize that Israel is the chosen nation, which is what Yitzhak Mitzrayim represents, we can receive the Torah as we say the bracha of the Torah, Baruch Hashem Elokim Achlam Asher Bach Arbanu, you chose me call Amim, you chose us from all the nations, V'nasan lanu es haTorah, and gave us the Torah. That's what the bracha of the Torah is, but that's really defines what the Jews are. You chose us from all the nations, and you gave us our Torah, you gave us your Torah, his Torah. Sometimes it's impossible to absorb the complex developed faith that's assimilated in the intellect without first discovering simple natural faith, and therefore first you need the basic faith and you gotta build on it. Therefore it's important to connect the whole holiday Pesach to that of Shavuot. The counting of Omer is a link and a ladder that connects these two holidays. So Pesach connects to Shavuot, and that's really with the theme of many Mefarshim point out that Pesach is really going to Shavuot. We're connecting these two ideas. It's almost like the beginning of Sukkot comes to the end of Sukkot. So the days of Sfiras HaOmer are like connecting Pesach to Shavuot. The days of the Omer are like a super long chalamoid of 7 weeks between the holiday of Pesach to the holiday of Shavuot, in the same way that Sukkot has a chalamoid of 5 days in the middle between the first days of Sukkot and between Shmini Atzeres and Simchas Torah. So that's just first piece itself. Now, how do you count? Okay. Hope I know you're counting. This is maybe a little too late to do. I wanted to do it earlier on, but it's good. Excuse me. Here's the bracha you make. Every bracha, everything you do makes a bracha. If you didn't count, of course, and you left one day, you say the counting without a bracha. But the brachas that you've sanctified as Shegusham, Yitzvano, Alzvira, Soma, regarding counting the Omer. Right, you say we should be saying standing up. By the way, this is a general rule that people should be standing when doing a mitzvah. Very rarely are we doing mitzvahs in a sitting position. I'm sure there's a few you can think of, but basically you should be standing when you do the mitzvah, a mitzvah. If one said them while sitting, he nonetheless fulfilled the obligation. So today the custom has become that people stand up when the bride and groom walk by to the chuppah. That's a very recent custom, by the way. It did not exist when I was a little kid. But it makes sense to the extent that the bride and groom are doing a mitzvah to get married, mitzvah to create a family. So we're also joining in their mitzvah, we're also standing up with them. And by the way, bride and groom should be standing. You never saw a bride and groom sitting down, did you? Can't be done. I mean, unless they can't stand. But if they're able to stand, they need to be standing because that's the mitzvah they're doing. Mitzvahs require being standing because you're standing in the presence of Hashem. There are two components to the count. You count the days and counting the weeks. As the Musaq says, this was last week's parsha, Sfartim Lachem Imachos HaShabbos. You're going to count from the day after Shabbos, Miyom HaVeyachem HaTomer HaTnufa, from the day after you bring the Om of Waving, Sheva Shabbatot Mimotiyenu, you'll count 7 complete weeks, Ad Mimachos HaShabbos HaShviz Tishbucham Shimiyom, you count 50 days. You're counting weeks, and you're counting 50 days. And that's how we count. So for example, today is the 30th day of the Omer, so you said last night, or you would say today, Hayom Shloshim Yom, today is 30 days, Shehem Shtei Shel, Shehem Arba Shavos, Ushnei Yomim Lomer. It's 30 days, which is 4 weeks and 2 days. So we're counting the weeks as well as counting the days based upon the verbiage of the Torah. Therefore, you have to tally the days and the weeks when counting the Omer. So the one's going to give you the examples, right? Today, Yom Shiva Yom, today is 7 days. And the 14th day, we say, Hayom Asher Abasa Yom, today is the 14th day. We don't say, by the way, we don't do the same thing we do on the days of the week. We say, Hayom Yom Rishon, Hayom Yom Sheni. Right? We don't say today, like today when you count, say the Psalm of the day. What was today? Today was Monday. Today is Monday. So you said, Hayom Yom Sheni Bashabbos. Today is the second day. We don't say that when we count the Omer. We said, Hayom Shnei Yomim. Today is 2 days. Right? We would have said it on the second day of the Omer. Today we said, today is Shloshim Yom. We didn't say it's Yom Shloshim, the 30th day. It's 30 days. And the answer is because we're connecting them all together. So we don't say Yom Shloshim. We say Shloshim Yom. It's not just the day itself, but there's a connection. That's why the bracha, if you miss the connection, you left one out, you leave out the bracha. Okay, so we're counting that we went through that. Several versions of the text of the Omer count. Some count La Omer, some count Ba Omer. Is it 30 days in the Omer, of the Omer, in the Omer? It's the same thing. Today's 14 days in the Omer. Some say together, of Le Ba, and so forth. Some say, use it at the end, Hayom. Some say today, Hayom Yom Arbasa Yom Ba Omer, Shehem Shnei Shavuot. But our custom is usually to Hayom Arbasa Yom, Shehem Shnei Shavuot La Omer. We put the word Omer at the end, though there is a variation. Some say Omer right after counting the days. Our tradition makes more sense. One fulfills the obligation no matter which version he uses, right? We say, some people have say L'Shem Yichud, which is like a preparatory paragraph. Okay, the number 7 alludes to a complete phenomena, which for the world was created in 7 days. Indeed, every physical entity has 6 sides, 4 sides, the top and the bottom, plus, of course, the 7th aspect, its inner core, the center. So this is Maharal says that the completeness is 7. 6 sides of a cube, plus the center dot in the middle of the cube, makes the cube complete. Man has 7 sides, which is why it takes 7 days to go from a state of impurity to one of purity. For 7 days, a person prepares all the aspects to make this transformation. So you work for 6 days and you rest on the 7th. The land works for 6 day years and rests on the 7th. That's Parshas Shavuah. The same is true, let's just finish this up here, the same is true of purifying oneself for sacred endeavors in the world, like eating, truma, and sacrificial foods, as well as a woman going to mikvah. For husband, however, in order to absorb God's Torah, whose lofty nature belongs to the supernal worlds, we need to count much deeper, not just 7 days. Not just seven days become from Tomei to Tahar, but 7 weeks, 7 times 7. Each in this count, each one of the 7 numbers appears in all 7 aspects. And this way our purification in advance of the giving of Torah is complete. Every aspect of our character undergoes refinement and expression and expresses yearning and anticipation for the receiving of the Torah. So yes, it's got to go through a week to reach number 7. And by the way, the two go together. You can't start at number 7 and work the way to number 6. You got to start from 1, and when you finish the 6, you come to, of course, number 7 itself. It's pretty much what it is. The things changed after the Churban HaBayis, when the Beis Hamikdash is destroyed, and there's no longer bringing of the Omer. That's a question that we'll just deal with very quickly here. So we don't have the bringing of the Omer in the Beis Hamikdash anymore. How does that affect the counting the Omer? It's a big discussion. According to the Rosh, Ran, and many other Rishonim, the biblical command to count the Omer's effect only when we offer the Omer of waving of the barley in the temple on the 16th of Nisan, in the temple. However, today we don't have the offering, you don't have the Karban Omer, so therefore we only have the mitzvah mid the Rabban, rabbinically ordained. The rabbis enacted in commemoration of the Omer count that took place when the temple counted. Many things fall, by the way, so we don't have a temple. This is why we're accustomed to praying for the rebuilding of the Beis Hamikdash after we finish counting this. In other words, after you say the count, let's say, Hayom Shloshim Yom Shem Shnei Shavuos Shehem Arba Shavuos Shnei Yom Lomer. So we say, HaRachamu Yachzu Lan Arvos Beis Hamikdash Lom Kalma, God should be allow us. He will have mercy on us. Rachamu Yachzu will build the Beis Hamikdash, bring the Beis Hamikdash back to its place because we want to do the mitzvah on a higher level. So we'll be able to do it on a biblical level. Rambam and Ravid and Ravio believe that Omer offering is mentioned to teach us the day in which the Omer count begins. It's not a condition. So according to the Rambam and the Ravio, we're counting Menat Torah, still counting even though we don't have a Beis Hamikdash. But we'd love to have a Beis Hamikdash anyway. The real question becomes, what if you don't know if you counted Sfiras Omer? That can happen. You know, you're so busy. Well, you thought you planned to count it, but you didn't count it. You should count it. Did you count it or not? For example, if you count it during the twilight period, you don't know, is it the right day or the wrong day? So if you consider twilight day, you didn't fulfill the obligation. It's not yet the day. If it's night, you did fulfill the obligation. The Aruch HaShulchan, the majority of posts, counts the one who counts during twilight, did the obligation, because in his opinion, the Omer count is a rabbinic mitzvah. We have a suffix and a drabbanon mitzvah, we are more makel. Many Achronim write this proper to act strictly and recount without a blessing after the emergence of stars in order to fulfill the mitzvah, even according to those who hold that the Omer is a biblical mitzvah nowadays, which requires one to act strictly in case of doubt. So therefore, better to wait till it's fully dark. If you think you may count it later, you can count it even once sunset has happened. You do it usually on condition, I hope I'll count it later again. But you can count it at that point, and you b'dieved, if you didn't count it later, you will have done the mitzvah itself. But just a big machlokas, is this considered a rabbinic mitzvah or is it considered a biblical mitzvah? And we often forget how much intertwined we are with the existence or lack of a Beis Hamikdash, which of course really kind of brings us full circle to really what Rav Kook was talking about, which is about coming back to Eretz Yisrael, building a society, setting things up, including eventually the final redemption of the Beis Hamikdash. That's really where Rav Kook hopes things would end up, not about just building up a secular land. Kind of ran through.
Rabbi,
yes?
I heard recently that there are some opinions that say counting the day is biblical.
Right, and counting
it's not the, tied to bringing the Omer.
And counting the weeks.
Counting the weeks,
yes,
is, yeah, rabbinic.
You are correct, 100%. That is correct. There's one opinion that says days are biblical and weeks are rabbinic. No, the other way around. Days, where today we can do it biblically to count the days, and we can't do it without the Beis Hamikdash, and we don't get to count the weeks. Correct. 100%.
Right.
Good. Thanks for saying, adding that in. Okay, guys, there we go. 12 o'clock. Have a wonderful day. Have a rainy day. Have a rainy, happy day. It's good for the plants. Good for those trees that are trying to figure out how to send signals to you. Okay. Yom Tov, everybody. Have a good day.
Well,
good to see you, Jeff. Good to have you back. Okay, welcome back. Avram?
Yeah, why you want to be a tree?
You want to be a tree? Why?
So you'll get rain on.
Okay. Yeah.